Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 7th, 2020, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled The Race to 5G and the World Radio Conference. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us our moderator, Patricia Paoletta, who is a partner at Harris, Wiltshire, and Grannis. After our panel gives their opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Patricia, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. For the listeners' background, I had the honor of serving as a delegate to the recently concluded World Radio Communications Conference. This is a treaty-level conference, meaning the world comes together every 4 years to negotiate changes to the treaty, which is the International Radio Regs. So we are very fortunate to have on this panel senior folks from the three agencies that originally made up the core delegation of the United States delegation. And we'll start with introducing Grace Coe, who was the head of the U.S. delegation to the World Radio Conference, which I will probably call either the conference or the WARC, W-R-C, and give a little background on her in a moment. We have Doug Kinkoff, who is the Associate Administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Agency. That's within our administration. That's within Commerce Department. He's got a very long title, which is on the web page, but basically it's written by a lawyer, I'm assuming, but it boils down to Doug currently being the acting head of NTIA, but yes, his official title is Associate Administrator there. And we have Tom Sullivan, who is the chief of the FCC's International Bureau, and giving a little background on them. Their full bios are available, of course, on the website when you click on them. But Grace has worn a couple hats over the last couple of years prior to serving and moving over to the State Department and serving as our head of our U.S. delegation. She was practicing law at DLA Piper. Before that, she was an advisor, a special assistant to President Trump on technology, telecom, and cybersecurity in the National Economic Council. Prior to that, she was deputy chief counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Subcommittee on Communications and Technology. Doug also has a very illustrious background in that he's the only one of us who's actually served in an operational role in the industry. He also, at NTIA, has worked on a number of the broadband programs, you know, with the funds to support broadband deployment. So he would certainly have a great idea of the importance of getting broadband out there and the role that the World Radio Conference had in terms of facilitating more deployment, both in the U.S. as well as globally, since it is a global conference. And then Tom is a longtime veteran of the FCC, but he's been serving as the chief of the International Bureau since Ajit Pai became the chairman back in 2017. Prior to that, was chief of staff of the Bureau for a long time. I learned from reading his bio that he has a master's in public policy from Michigan, right? So I think other than Grace, we have a fully Midwestern panel, so it's going to be a very friendly panel. So, you know, I look forward to that. In any event, yes, the panel's on the race to 5G and the World Radio Conference. I think it was Grace's current colleague, but one who was detailed from Doug's agency, NTIA, who first, to my ears, referred to this as the 5G WARC because of the priority 70 countries, including the U.S., were giving to, you know, to 5G and getting more spectrum for 5G. And as I noted earlier, these conferences, the world comes together to negotiate spectrum allocations and a number of the agenda items, but kind of the big one that took a lot of energy from all the countries was to provide more spectrum identifications for what the International Telecommunications Union, which is a body of the United Nations, and that's the international body that hosts and organizes the World Radio Conference, what they call International Mobile Telecom, IMT. You know, we generally think of that as cellular broadband, but you know, the definition's all different. But IMT 2020, and we're now in the year 2020, that flavor of IMT is considered 5G. So there was a lot of focus on 5G. But I'm going to let our illustrious panelists kind of jump in there. So I'll start with Grace. What you saw at the World Radio Conference, did it impact the U.S.'s ability to run the race, to win the race to 5G?
Thanks, Tricia. First of all, thanks to the Federalist Society and also to Tricia for putting this together. I think Tricia mentioned that this is a relatively, or as she mentioned earlier, that this is a relatively arcane conference. It's an arcane field of law, regulatory law. So very glad to be able to talk a little bit about this with all of you. It's very exciting, and you know, it combines geopolitics with technology and all sorts of other intrigue, but it is fairly little known, so it is a good way to sort of give you an introduction to this topic. So the race to 5G, it's an interesting term for what we're currently involved in as we go, as the world goes from 4G to 5G, but it is 5G is largely seen as a general platform technology that will be very game-changing for, I think, all other technologies that run on top of it. All countries are interested in deploying quickly and being sort of the ground, the base camp for where all of these new technologies, these new ecosystems evolve. What we have here is a conference that focused on millimeter wave spectrum, which is spectrum above, I think, 22 gigahertz. And that's really very high. This is bandwidths that are very high, and they also lend themselves to being allocated in large swaths, gigahertz-sized swaths that would allow for really large pipes that allow for very high bandwidths, like 1 gigabit per second. 5G will need millimeter wave spectrum, mid-band spectrum, and low-band spectrum, but in this case, we were talking about millimeter wave spectrum, and we allocated, the conference agreed to allocate spectrum for millimeter wave spectrum to 5G in a way that is very, very congenial to what the United States band plan is, which basically means that the United States already has, to some degree, a head start on actual millimeter wave deployments. We are one of very few countries who have begun deploying in the 28 gigahertz band. Going forward, there will be equipment manufactured for the particular bands that we have, as the United States, already targeted for 5G deployment. That puts us in a very good position. So I'm quite confident in saying that the United States feels very good about its prospects for, quote unquote, winning the 5G race.
Well, thank you, Grace. That's very helpful. And Tom, your agency, the FCC, is actually the body in the U.S. that awards licenses to U.S. providers of broadband, mobile broadband, whether it's been 3G, 4G, and now 5G. But how did the World Radio Conference impact the FCC's plans in that regard? Is Grace accurate in your view that what came out was congenial to sort of the FCC's plans for 5G, at least in the millimeter wave spectrum?
Thank you, Tricia, and thanks to the Federalist Society. One thing I've learned, Tricia, is Grace is still an ambassador, I believe, so of course she is right. But if you'll allow... If you will allow me, I can elaborate a little bit more because, as you and I hope all of our listeners know, the FCC has been very active in promoting and helping our nation seize the opportunities of 5G and the new digital age. It's a very exciting time, and under Chairman Pai's leadership, the FCC has been making more spectrum available to power this new digital economy and enable the next generation of technologies and services that Grace was just alluding to. In addition, many of the WRC agenda items also deal with something else that we've been working hard on, which is closing the digital divide, or trying to close that digital divide, connecting the unconnected, and promoting new breakthroughs across the communications sector. So how did the WRC fit into these actions and our domestic policies? I'll start with the 5G aspect. One of our broad goals with 5G was to make sure that we created a flexible regulatory framework that allowed for the continued growth and rollout of this new and exciting service, and not just for 5G mobile, but we're also looking to make sure that we allowed for the flexibility for other services such as satellite, broadcast, and Wi-Fi. The second big goal that the FCC had, overarching again, is to enable regional and global spectrum harmonization opportunities for all of these services. We want to create these international economies of scale, which will allow roaming. Our devices can work wherever we go. Interoperability, and importantly for consumers and manufacturers, we want to lower prices of these devices as they get deployed. And the third big goal was to enable and ensure that we had reasonable protections for the users of the spectrum. Because as we're advancing to these new upper millimeter wave bands, we had incumbent users there. Some federal users, some non-federal users, and it was very important that we made sure that we provided protection, appropriate protection, so that they can continue to operate and have enough certainty to invest, as well as the new incumbents, that they can invest in the new technologies and expand coverage and deployment. As a result of the WRC, and with respect to the specific question in terms of the race to 5G, I think it was a extremely successful conference. WARC 19, as Grace noted, I dub it the connectivity conference. And when it comes to 5G, it certainly is the high band conference in terms of connectivity. WARC 19 identified several high spectrum bands, both for regional and global allocations. And the important thing there is that it gives administrations the flexibility to use these bands for 5G. Notably, all of the high spectrum bands the U.S. pursued at WRC 19 for 5G were obtained, including the bands we're currently auctioning right now at the FCC in our current auction, which is the upper 37 gigahertz, 39 gigahertz, and 47 gigahertz bands, which as of yesterday's closing bids, I believe totaled about $6.2 billion. So a very timely and appropriate time for this conference to happen, and a resounding success that we were able to achieve these global harmonizations that allowed that to happen. The high spectrum bands that were at stake at this conference are going to be the workhorse bands for ultra-fast, low-latency, high-capacity applications of the future. So it was a very important priority for the U.S., and we're very happy that overall I think the conference provided 17.25 gigahertz of spectrum that was identified for mobile use at the conference. And that compares with about 1.9 gigahertz of bandwidth, which was available before the WARC 19 conference. So we've really globally pushed and allocated significant blocks of spectrum so that the U.S. can win the race and lead the race for 5G for a long time.
Well, thank you, Tom. Yeah, that is an impressive achievement in terms of just the sheer number of gigahertz that, you know, the U.S. was able to get globally harmonized. You had mentioned protecting federal incumbents, and of course, Doug, to you, I think many, if not all of our listeners might know that in the U.S. we have a kind of bifurcated spectrum management framework where the FCC regulates and licenses private sector use of spectrum and also local government, you know, public safety use, but NTIA actually manages federal use of spectrum. So, you know, yet NTIA sits in the Commerce Department, so you kind of wear two hats, but and certainly NTIA has been active in the policy discussions and achievements for 5G, but, you know, maybe you could elaborate on what was NTIA's role at the World Radio Conference relative to promoting, you know, 5G?
I would say that, as Tom alluded to, that we are in sync on helping to ensure that the U.S. is the leader in 5G now and going forward. Where the FCC is focused on rolling out spectrum to the commercial marketplace, NTIA is focused on how we can support that through making federal spectrum available for commercial use, but while also protecting federal missions. Largest user of spectrum in the U.S. is the Department of Defense. So usually all of our spectrum discussions involve what the impact is on the Department of Defense, but it could also be Department of Transportation, Energy, it could be virtually any agency. So our role at the WRC, we had folks on the Cordell, was to ensure that the message of the federal agencies was protected, the missions. So basically, we work with the FCC to help and the delegation to get harmonization of the spectrum. But what we do is convey our concerns and our message to the delegation as to what the federal agencies can live with or can't live with. And if we decide to go forward on something, what is the potential harm or impact, I should say, to a federal agency? So we are there to basically represent all of the executive branch federal agencies at the WRC.
Very interesting. And a quick follow-up. So, and Grace, one of you can address this, because I believe this was the largest U.S. delegation that we fielded before. But, you know, Doug specifically, how many folks were there from the federal spectrum user side, if you have a rough count?
Federal spectrum users, we had 9 there from NTIA. NASA was there. I think DOD came later in after I had left, Grace. I don't know if you have a count or a ballpark.
I was just thinking, just recalling, you know, this actually wasn't the largest delegation that we've ever had. I think last WARCS delegation was about 180 people. And this WARCS delegation was probably closer to 130. Part of that was probably just the fact that this conference was held in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, as opposed to Geneva, where it's typically held. And I'd say this particular conference, we had about half and half, so half private sector, half government, if you consider there are a lot of government contractors that came that I don't necessarily count as private sector. And just to add a little bit to what Doug was saying about federal spectrum use and NTIA's interest, in a lot of situations, you'll find that quite a bit of the satellite use actually does speak not just to the commercial users. I mean, it's the satellite questions that are teed up at the WRC are not just aimed at sort of increasing commercial operations, but also increasing the ability of the government to do quite a few things. So there's a lot of crossover there. And I think we'll see more of that with 5G as the government itself, not just the U.S. government, but governments globally become more invested in the use of 5G as a platform for their services and abilities.
You all kind of mentioned, directly or indirectly, obviously 5G has a lot of promise, the next generation. Why would it take 4 weeks, and of course 4 weeks after a culmination of 4 years, for countries to negotiate and agree on conditions for 5G, you know, in the millimeter wave bands? And any of one of you can jump in.
You know, Tricia, I think there are a bunch of people who actually believe that if you gave us 1 week, we would just like figure it out in 1 week.
husband is among them, by the way. But
I can just imagine. I mean, the real pressure does come at the end of the conference to actually finalize those deals. But I will point out that, and please, Tom and Doug, jump in. I'm just going to start the answer on this one, but certainly the 4 years of studies are extraordinarily helpful in informing which positions each country should take. So these are questions about whether or not, you know, to some degree, all spectrum is, the usage has to be shared or managed, because there are incumbent services either already in the band or adjacent to the band that we're currently looking at. So you do want to make sure that there's a clear understanding of the levels of interference or activity that will be that may impact other existing services. And then 4 weeks, probably give or take, is useful to have, because there are such a large number of topics that come up. In this particular instance, I think there were some 38 actual questions that needed to be answered. And I can tell you that even though I joke about maybe the work really doesn't need the full 4 weeks, I can't remember a single instance where I think there wasn't a study group or a drafting group or a discussion group that didn't go on into the evenings to continue and try to finalize those discussions quickly.
Hi, this is Tom from the FCC, and I'll provide an additional perspective, which is that, you know, we're blessed and fortunate that we can send sufficient delegation of, you know, federal experts as well as our private sector experts. Many countries that attend the WARC and are instrumental in helping achieve consensus may only have a handful of individuals, some one or two people as examples. And for them, it becomes a little bit more important to be able to, you know, sit in the drafting group sessions to understand what would work best for their country and get perspective. So while I'm a big believer that we, And after being there for the 30 days, would have loved to have seen a shorter conference. There are probably some needs of some of the smaller countries and the developing nations to use this as an opportunity to build their positions and be informed, and to also work with their regional groups, which we haven't talked about yet, but which is another very important element of the WRC, is to how we come together in our regional ITU groups to get to these positions, to really help advance things, using the football terminology, you know, to the 20-yard line, and then, you know, we have to, you know, figure out how we're going to negotiate to get into that, into the end zone. So I'll turn it back to you, Tricia, but I wanted to interject that perspective as well.
Yeah, and then for our listeners to prepare for these conferences, as well as just to do studies on spectrum use and harmonization throughout, you know, the year, throughout the study cycle, the four-year study cycle, the United Nations International Telecommunication Union divides the world up into three basic regions. So if you think of the world as a big orange, you know, divide it into three, cut the segments or pull the segments apart until you have three big chunks. And region one is, you know, as appropriate for Greenwich Mean Time, you know, where time begins, right, is region one is Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. And as the world spins, you know, you go west. Region two is the Americas. Region three is Asia. And as Tom alluded to, you prepare for these world radio conferences as is appropriate, because, you know, spectrum doesn't stop at a border. You prepare for these spectrums within your region. So the U.S. Prepared for getting its positions on these, you know, 38 different agenda items that Grace mentioned. You know, the work agenda has, you know, are spelled out, and there are 38 odd issues when you count them all up with the various different agenda item titles. So the U.S. prepared within its region, and the regional body is part of the Organization of American States, the Commission on International Telecommunications, so that acronym is CTEL. And, you know, over the four-year cycle, the U.S. worked with its neighbors in CTEL to develop positions. Let me go back to Doug. Obviously, 5G, as Grace mentioned and Tom mentioned, you know, was an important issue for a number of countries, particularly in our, well, all over the world, but including in our region. However, I think it's fair to say that within our region, CTEL, and you mentioned this yourself, Doug, that with the Department of Defense being the biggest user in the United States of the spectrum, you know, some of those issues probably were more important relative to federal government use than maybe some of our other neighbors in the region, right? But, how, you know, so, Doug, for you, how did you perceive, you know, CTEL's interest in federal spectrum use? Was it usually the U.S. defending federal spectrum use, or is that a broadly felt issue with our neighbors in the region?
Thanks, Tricia. I will admit up front, before my time, I was not engaged in the CTEL portion of this, but the feedback from the team here at NTIA that worked closely with CTEL and Tom and Grace, you guys did, that there was good collaboration in the CTEL organization. In fact, I think we came out with pretty much a very much harmonious positions, agreed to positions out of CTEL to the WRC. Military spectrum and equipment sales are very well coordinated, is my understanding, with CTEL, and you would expect that given the makeup of that organization. But I would defer to Grace and Tom to give you a little more insight on the actual internal dealings of the group.
I think the military ties are very important, obviously. I think perhaps it's safe to say that maybe our military ties are spread throughout the globe, so they're not particular necessarily to CTEL. But there are certain battles that we do need to make sure that we win at CTEL in order to protect, I think, the military interests. And sometimes those battles are particularly important. For example, if we need to protect, I think, certain types of spectrum that are used only in the United States for particular military exercises, for example, we may need to be out of sync with our American neighbors, or we may need to persuade them that it's in all of our best interests in order to be able to keep this particular band protected. So there are sort of fights that go, or debates that go on at CTEL that that keep the United States out of sync with its neighbors. But I think generally speaking, we have a good relationship and we do tend to be more in sync with Vitel than not. Tom, I don't know if you have more to add on that, but I think...
Yeah.
Another point where we are probably in sync with CETEL generally is that when you have the United States, Brazil, Mexico, Canada in agreement, we're in fairly good shape usually. It's probably a more harmonious region than not.
Yeah, those are excellent points, Grace. And I would say, you know, being in the FCC for a long time, that under this administration, I've seen our cohesiveness within CETEL as one of the strongest that it's been. This goes back to the 2018 Plenipotentiary Conference, where we worked with CETEL. This is another ITU conference. It's essentially their big constitutional convention, and it's also where they elect their officials. In preparation for this conference, we had over 50 inter-American proposals. Those are common proposals from the CETEL member states, and they carry significant weight when you can get these inter-American proposals. So going into the 2018 Plenipot, we had more inter-American proposals than we've ever had going into a plenipotentiary conference. And as a result, the U.S. achieved, I think, excellent success coming out of there on the substantive policy side, but also because of our cohesiveness and our ability to work well within CETEL at that 2018 conference, we were able to elect two representatives from our region to the ITU, the highest positions at the ITU. Doreen Bogdan-Martin, a U.S. woman, the first woman ever elected to an ITU high-level position, was a significant achievement. And we also elected someone else from the region, from Uruguay, Mario Manovic, who is the ITUR director head and the one who ran this conference that we were just at in Egypt. And to have two from that region where we had no one before was a significant, significant event and really showed the cohesiveness that the U.S. was able to lead and bring into CETEL, and we carried that momentum forward under Grace and Grace's leadership and working collaboratively with our interagency partners in preparation for the WRC. There was maybe some slow starts, as there usually are in the first cycles of the CETEL meetings, but by the end, we were able to achieve an amazing number, again, of inter-American proposals coming out of CETEL. I think, virtually almost every item. There might have been a few where we didn't have that type of consensus. And that makes us very strong going into the World Radio Conference because you have the back of all of those member states behind you when you need them, and you carry their votes, essentially, even though it's not a voting conference. But in terms of consensus, you can speak as CETEL. So that was a very significant event, and we worked very well with the leadership of CETEL and with the other states in the CETEL administrations to help advance U.S. leadership. So I think it was a very successful outcome, and I think, great to have Grace at those CETEL events and building that collaboration. So that was a very important victory for us.
Well, thank you, Tom. And as is true for the other major regions, right, we have a diverse region filled with rich and powerful countries, filled with some developing countries, diverse interests. I agree with you that we seem to be more united than in some past cycles. Other countries legitimately caring about each other's priorities and interests and, a lot of, listening to and understanding. I think that does impact how we also advocated for different positions, on the ground, as it were, in Egypt. I have to say that did not seem to be shared by some other countries that I observed anyway. It seemed to be, China, in my observation, was very aggressive, pushing Huawei interests and, typically Huawei interests. Sometimes there were other interests at play. Russia was very oppositional relative to, probably protecting some of their military interests, but it did seem at times to be they were oppositional to everything the U.S. or CETEL wanted just for the sake of, building leverage. But Yeah, so how about your observation? And we can start with Doug. And you were on the ground for a little while. How did China and Russia come across to you, Doug?
In my 1 week there, doing the bilats and then listening in on the plenary sessions, I didn't sit in the staff-level working groups where you may see that more. But definitely there were times where I think they wanted their voices heard. You may not have said Iran in there, but they were active also.
Yeah, you're right. I should have mentioned them.
That's the voice ringing in my head right now. Yeah, I agree with that. Sometimes it is, I think, the ambassador might be better to answer this, but absolutely, to go counter the U.S. Just for the sake of countering the U.S. or, you know, gaining leverage with their core group. But yeah, I did notice that. Didn't go unnoticed, but I did not see a high level of animosity between us and them, at least at the events that I was associated with.
Madam Ambassador, you want to add that?
Oh, it got interesting after you left that.
Oh, yeah.
No. I think you summed it up pretty well, Tricia. There was a lot of general sort of opposition. So, and if you take Russia, they tended to be very protective of scientific interests. And the stance that they took was to protect, to the detriment, I think, of other countries' interests in expanding commercial services, you know, to protect, I think, what they might have termed scientific services or scientific/military services in particular spectrum bands. And in other instances, I quite frankly remember quite a few delegates saying this, but they, it was not clear what Russia was actually trying to do other than be obstructionist. Now, they could have been doing exactly that, just they could have been seeking to be obstructionist simply to gain leverage in other negotiations, or they could legitimately have had other reasons for not wanting to agree with where consensus was generally heading. But that was a very interesting and difficult dynamic to deal with. For us, I think, I would say most of the issues that took, I think, until the very end of the conference to resolve, and Tom and Doug, I don't know if you recall differently, mostly there were there was always a Russian element to each one of those particular questions that we had to resolve. As for the Chinese, I found them quite fascinating. They are very eager to learn how to work this conference and to promote their particular spectrum plans and spectrum ideals, especially with the idea of ensuring that their Chinese companies will be world players on the stage. So certainly Huawei, I think they expect to have the same sort of commercial worldwide success with their satellite services as well. But they were quite aggressive and quite willing to be out there in front protecting their national interests for a number of different services. So it wasn't just the 6 gigahertz future agenda item that they had been pushing on behalf of Huawei, but also, I think, protecting certain spectrum for future, I think, satellite services, and to the point where I think they were quite willing to make themselves unpopular with neighboring countries in order to achieve their goals. One thing else I'll note is that they were quite, we had several conversations with them, but they were quite taken with the idea that the United States tends to do a lot of outreach before the actual WRC takes place. So, the core delegation and I had a lot of did a lot of traveling to a variety of different countries to speak to them about what our priorities were and to understand what their priorities were and to figure out how we could align those. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we see China doing similar things in the future, because I think they are very quick to learn from good practices like the ones that we've been doing for quite some time.
Very interesting. Thank you, Grace. Certainly, I was aware of their activities on, for Huawei in the 6 gigahertz band, which is a band of spectrum they're targeting for the next generation of 5G, IMT 2020. In the U.S., the FCC has proposed unlicensed use in that band. That, of course, is still pending. But I hadn't thought of the satellite interest that they were pushing, other than, of course, in the 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi discussions, which were long and painful because we had both China and Russia being very oppositional. But to Tom, as the U.S. licensor of satellite, commercial satellite operators, did you perceive that from China, or from your perch as the chief of the International Bureau. What's China up to in terms of, you know, satellite, certainly commercial, but satellite generally?
Well, I think they have one particular satellite interest that they've advanced for the Work 2023, and that's with a future GMDSS, which is a maritime safety and distress system that they would like to push for Work 2023. Grace might elaborate a little bit on that after I conclude, but that's one of their, you know, major priorities that we've already identified. Clearly, they're also very interested in, you know, being a, you know, leader in space technology, and are actively, you know, out in front with their, you know, launches, their capabilities, demonstrations. So something that they're definitely going to want to, you know, advance their technologies there for communications capabilities and other federal capabilities that they want to have strategic advantages with. So we will be, you know, watching them there. At the WRC, in terms of the satellite agenda items that I was following closely, it was actually more Russia that we were dealing with in terms of difficulties. But I think it speaks to Grace's point, where she noted their recalcitrance, if you will, on many agenda items, potentially using that, you know, to trade in for leverage on other issues that they had cared more deeply about. We did see on one of the big items that we were pursuing for NGSOs, so that they could, these new satellite systems like SpaceX, Telesat, OneWeb, can have the opportunity to share spectrum with the GSOs and not interfere with them. There was another element to that agenda item where Russia was particularly difficult, and we had to came down to the, you know, even the 11th hour of the 11th hour. I think that one concluded a little bit later than the 5G IMT one, with Russia just resistance and are just standing up to them in that one meeting. So it was a very interesting element there. And as a Grace, if you wanted to elaborate a little bit more on China and the GMDSS issue, I'm happy to turn that back to you.
I think, I mean, you've essentially said it all on the GMDSS issue, but they were particularly resistant in providing, in assuring or agreeing to, rather, that this new GMDSS, which is Global Marine Distress Safety System. This is a service that you would think that everyone would welcome, given that it's a safety of life service that allows mariners to receive, I think, navigation warnings, to weather information, and then takes actual distress calls. And this new service that would have entered into the marketplace with the approval by the WRC would actually have covered polar regions, which has not been done to date. But I think China was unwilling to allow it to go forward with its full swath of spectrum, but instead wanted to reserve some of that spectrum for itself. And that was very apparent. Other places where I think they have satellite systems in some of the spectrum that was identified for 5G. And while they allowed for a certain number of countries to identify, identify that spectrum for 5G by footnote, it started to block other countries from allowing them to take advantage or to identify that spectrum, essentially prohibiting those countries from using that spectrum for 5G because of its nearby satellite systems, or because it was concerned about interference to its satellite systems. So I think that, you know, there are, and they fought very hard on a number of other NGSO issues, where I think ultimately France probably stymied them the most on that one. But you could see quite a bit of a struggle there. And there was a real interest in sort of pushing forward, I think, a number of satellite priorities for China. It will be interesting to see how they prepare for the next WRC and how they will present, I think, their positions. I think when the United States goes towards presenting its positions, I think we try to show that our positions make sense, not just for the United States, but for, I think, spectrum, but make good spectrum policy generally. I think we do that so that one, our positions do tend to be more persuasive, and two, because, I mean, this is a global conference. Do you feel that, you know, the positions taken by the conference or the positions adopted by the conference should benefit the world? Certainly we have the U.S. interest first and foremost, but it's just jarring, I think, when you have one country coming in beating the drum for its own national interest as hard as I think China was.
And if you don't mind, Trisha, I do want to say that I think they stood out at this conference more than any other conference in that type of posturing that they took. Everyone took notice that, getting back to Grace's point, that they were preventing other countries from signing on to these footnotes that Grace mentioned, which would give them the flexibility of using spectrum. But they were, usually you would reserve that for countries that are you're bordered with, so you share a common border, and you, or that they're proximate to you, or an island perhaps off. But here we were seeing them do that where countries were in different regions or no shared borders with China. For example, in Africa, and they prevented countries from doing that. So it was a very unusual step that we saw with respect to that.
Thank you. Now, you guys mentioned the agenda for WARC 23 and some of China's and others' interests. For our listeners, and I'm going to open it to questions in a moment, but you mentioned, right, WARC 23. So at a existing or current conference, not only do folks, you know, negotiate and haggle and browbeat and do, you know, late night meetings on the 38 agenda items that were on this agenda, as Grace mentioned, but they also negotiate the agenda for the next four-year study cycle and for decision in 4 years, so at WARC 23. So that was negotiated and agreed to by the end of this past WARC. By the end of November, we had an agenda for WARC 23. So I'm going to turn it back to Doug before we open it up to listener questions. But Doug, from NTIA's perspective, what are some of the most important agenda items on the WARC 23 agenda?
My team would tell me that all of them are important at this phase. You know, mobile broadband issues, satellite, space science, aviation, maritime are all of, you know, I'll say initial peak items for us. But I think it's too early in the process to basically prioritize. I can tell you a priority item will continue to be the IMT mid-band, things that will help us continue to be able to provide more mid-band 5G spectrum. And, you know, over the next year, the state, FCC, NTIA, and the others will work together to kind of create that prioritization and start to work forward. And this was my first time going through a WRC, but, you know, start the process of our prioritization, then CTEL, and then back to the WRC. So I would say that right now I couldn't give you a priority list, but that the key will always be right now, the next, I think, cycle will be to look for that mid-band 5G window.
Interesting. And for our listeners, you know, the U.S. prepares for a conference kind of in a parallel manner. One, the FCC hosts a federal advisory committee, you know, FACA, to advise it on what positions it should take, you know, going into a CTEL meeting where the region first starts preparing for its position. And then, of course, simultaneously, NTIA hosts an interagency body, IRAC, the Interagency Radio Advisory Council or committee, you can correct me if you wish or if I'm inaccurate, and they formulate their positions, and then that gets reconciled at State Department, at Grace's agency, and then so the U.S. will get a position on a particular agenda item and send that into CTEL, and those meetings will kick off later this year. But at the same time, the studies, like the IMT mid-band being kind of a chunk of spectrum, maybe anywhere from, you know, 3 gigahertz to, you know, 7 gigahertz at this point, or even higher. The FCC had a mid-band proceeding, right, Tom, a couple of years back where it was 3 to 24 gigahertz. So the definitions of what mid-band expands. But anyway, so on the technical side, countries will prepare studies, and we'll be doing this on IMT mid-band, that they'll send to Geneva at the ITU study groups. So you have this parallel process. That's my little legal note. Doug, again, what were some of the non-commercial services that were under a lot of discussion. Obviously, before we went into the conference and before we finalized our positions at CETEL, there was trade press on, you know, disagreements between the federal users in the 24 gigahertz band that's, you know, the same band or close to the 24 gigahertz band, the same band that the FCC has already auctioned for 5G. But, and that was to protect Earth exploration sciences and some passive services. So, you know, what were some of the controversial issues apart from the commercial sector at the World Radio Conference?
I will say that the most controversial one is the one you're discussing, right, the 24. it was. I mean, the delegation did a great job of we came to a common ground before we went there, and we went in with a unified position. And those, during the first week there, the week I spent there and doing the bilats with the ambassador, this issue was raised a lot. As Grace mentioned, Russia, I think this is one of the issues in the last week. You know, you had Russia, the Europeans had a higher value than we did. But ultimately, I think we were able to come to a very successful resolution of this. So that was the most, what I'll say, the one that was kind of highest on our list of how we would be able to resolve that internationally. I'm not quite sure that I heard there were any disagreements before we left, though, Tricia.
Not after Grace got in place and tamped down all that fighting.
You know, and it's interesting because there was some of that in the press, but I would always say there's always disagreements between agencies, and that's part of the sausage-making process. And, you know, that wouldn't happen to get out in the press. But usually, you know, you do this, and it's a healthy debate on issues, and, you know, you ultimately work out to a resolution that is best for the American public. And we did here. I don't know, Grace and Tom, as it went on, if there were other issues that rose up, but I was not really privy to any from my team that were really a federal agency issue that became hotly debated while the WRC was going on.
Speaking of debating policy and approaches and looping back to what you and Tom are talking about, and for the record, Madam Ambassador did not use the word incalcitrance, Tom. I think that was just your word. So, certainly Russia and China were pretty difficult, and I've sat in, as did Commissioner O'Reilly, in a lot of the discussions on getting better international rules for Wi-Fi in a particular band of spectrum, 5 gigahertz, and he came away from that proposing a type of G7 of spectrum negotiations, you know, one that would not include Russia and China because of how obstructionist they were. And as you talked about, Tom, you know, blocking other countries that were far, far away in Africa from joining particular footnotes. And that, you know, that was hard to watch, you know, particularly when it was, you know, small developing countries who want better Wi-Fi rules. But, you know, what about the notion of having a G7 for spectrum or the flip side? You know, what's the benefit of the world coming together to negotiate spectrum? Wouldn't it be so much easier just to do it in a club of like-minded government managers?
Well, yeah, everyone should follow the U.S., what the U.S. spectrum policy is, and there'd be no debates. We wouldn't need to negotiate for 4 weeks.
I second that, Tom.
That's right. To your point, I think the frustration that Commissioner O'Reilly noted and observed firsthand is something where you're seeing where technology can be deployed to citizens or for global advantages being blocked, you know, for no particular valid technical or regulatory reason, right? But this happens at the WRCs. People block things because of competitive, they're trying to champion a particular company in their country. They want that standard to evolve or that spectrum to develop. The U.S. has an advantage due to our market size. We can be a first mover. We can attract manufacturers to build products. And I think Commissioner O'Reilly was speaking to the fact that we should not, as a first mover, along with the countries that tend to have progressive policies like South Korea and Japan, we shouldn't be punished for being early adopters. Regulations, therefore, should be flexible and should allow technology to evolve into tomorrow, because we know things aren't ever going to be as they are today. So we need to have that flexibility that he's looking for. I don't know that, you know, there's a particular solution in place, but I think it does speak to what we had to navigate at the WRC in order to achieve the results to get what we needed in many cases, and not what we necessarily deserved based on technical or regulatory merits.
Madam Ambassador?
I tend to agree. I always appreciate Commissioner O'Reilly's statements. I can understand the frustration completely, specifically because you do have situations where one country can completely stymie the ability of the world to actually come together and agree on new and innovative services. But I'm not sure that we can go elsewhere to do that, to make these decisions, because specifically because of the nature of spectrum. It doesn't stop at the border, so you can't say that this between these particular like-minded countries, we're going to agree that spectrum will do this, or that we'll agree on these particular satellite orbits, and nobody else can touch them. It's just the nature of the resources that we share that we end up having to undergo these multilateral discussions and having to endure some of our less agreeable neighbors. I don't mind saying recalcitrant. I mean, I think Tom might be onto something there. I do think it's worthwhile, however, to consider doing more in the way of, you know, maybe partnering with other like-minded nations and not limiting our engagement to CTEL, but for example, and we certainly don't try to do this by design, but you know, there is something to be said for, I think, coordinating more closely with like-minded nations, because you know, forming a large enough flock of like-minded nations can help you, I think, sway the other countries. And I think that was one of the things that helped take the American position on 24 gigahertz further, for example, because there were a large number of countries who agreed with where the United States was. Not just CTEL, but the Arab group and the African group were certainly there, and a large number of the Asian countries as well. That certainly is an effective mechanism for getting, getting more of our policies across.
So I want to thank Doug and Grace and Tom for a very interesting, insightful discussion on the importance of work, what it meant, how it's going to help the U.S. continue to lead in 5G and all these other services. So thank you, and I guess I'll turn it back over to our Federalist Society host for any closing housekeeping remarks.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.